This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome in, welcome in. This is a very important podcast. They're all important. We know that. We want to catch fish. We want to have fish for a long time. But this is an important one because our guy Shane Bonneau is going to help us and join us today to talk about some really important, timely things that are going on up and down the Gulf Coast with obviously oystering. That's been a popular topic and a very much discussed topic, but also trout regulations. We might even get into some crab trap cleanup and such. We're also going to have real good information on we know boat prices have gone up since the pandemic, but why exactly? And will they ever come down? We'll get to that with our guy, Chet Morimpudi over at Freedom Boats and all kinds of other stuff happening as well. Good question via the Bite Me group page on Facebook. And if you're not a member there, feel free to join. 7,200 of your friends have already joined at last check. And it's a really good place to have a good, healthy, apolitical discussion, as in non-political, riff-raff discussion, very, very healthy discussion on fishing topics, fishing strategies. A lot of the things that we do, most all of the things that we do here on the podcast come from you via the Bite Me group page. We also are on, Twitter at Lopez on Sports, Instagram at Lopez on Sports, and we have the Bite Me podcast Instagram page as well. So you can post some pictures, tag us, whatever you want to do. It's at @bite_me_podcast. And of course, don't forget to subscribe. The subscriptions have been off the charts and it just makes the podcast healthier for all of us, gives us better topics, more discussion. We got that network flying all over the place. And, one of the people involved there is Shane Bonneau. So, he's been, a good friend of the podcast as well. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, certainly on iTunes and Spotify, Google Podcasts, and everywhere else that you can get a podcast. So let's get right into it because this is going to be a big one. And I'm actually going to start with Shane. Captain Scott Knoll's right across from me, and so is Captain Caleb McCumber, and we're going to get some good fishing discussion with them. But I know they're going to have some good discussion and questions for Shane as well. So Shane, it's happening, so to speak. The oyster shutdowns, for lack of a better word, or suspensions, whatever you want to call it, are happening. But there's really news there as well with public hearings upcoming. Give us sort of the starting point, if you will, for what's happening and what people can do who are interested in this.
Yeah, thanks, John. So there's a couple things happening at the same time. You have a Parks and Wildlife has closed many of the public harvest areas. And as you guys know, the public oyster season starts in November and ends in April. And they open and close phase systems based upon how many keeper size oysters that they're catching in their samples, oysters larger than 3 inches, and how many they're catching per hour, per unit effort. So they have this system called a red light, green light, or traffic light system that they use. And it's all based on those metrics, catch rate and percent undersized. So throughout the season up to this point, they've closed almost all of the 34 shellfish harvest areas along the Texas coast. And for all practical purposes, the public fishery at this point in time is shut down. Most of the areas that have a high abundance of oysters naturally have either been fished out, at least the legal size oysters have been fished out, or those areas have been heavily affected by environmental conditions that killed a bunch of oysters prior to the season mm-hmm. being opened. You guys may remember all the fresh water that we received along the middle coast, and that killed a great number of oysters in Copano and Aransas Bay. So We started off the season with not a lot of oysters available, and we had a lot of pressure, number of boats fishing during the season. And we can go into all that later if you'd like. But right now, almost all the harvest areas are closed in the public fishery. And so, and at the same time, Parks and Wildlife has a proposal out for comment. And I suspect we'll spend a little bit of time talking about that. And so you can participate in that public comment process, but that proposal is to permanently prohibit oyster harvest in Ayers, Mesquite, and Carlos Bays, those bay systems between San Antonio and Aransas Bay. So that's where we sit today. The commission's going to vote on that proposal on March the 24th.
Okay.
At their next commission meeting.
Okay. Now, just let me backtrack real quick before we get to Scott and Caleb. Scott, I'll start with you because I know you got some stuff for Shane here. But just to backtrack, Shane, obviously, we've been talking about oysters a lot, but not everybody listens to every single podcast that we do. I hope they do, and I hope they can go back on all these platforms and listen to them all. But let's just sort of establish why this is so important for what we do every week, you know, fishing and such. I feel like we need to kind of reset that for our listeners who are like, well, wait a minute, you know, I like to catch fish. What does this have to do with my fishing? So if you could just kind of reset that.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for that. The, you know, oysters are a fishery. It is a commercial fishery. They provide product to the market, and it's important. It's an important part of our, it's an economic driver on the coast. But in addition to that, it is habitat. And we need to remember that oysters are a critical component of the habitat along the Texas coast. They help shore up our shorelines. They reduce erosion. They filter water. You know, every oyster filters 50 gallons of water per minute. They enhance the water quality, and they provide great spots for recreation for birders that like to look at wading birds on you know, is when they go out and do bird counts and check out, you know, look at the whooping cranes. That oysters along the shoreline is important for that. And then for recreational anglers, obviously we target those areas because those reefs hold a lot of fish. And the reason they hold a lot of fish is because that habitat in the water provides refuge and food for over 300 aquatic species. So it's an important component of the Texas coast, and it's not just a fishery. It's also habitat.
Just so it's clear, they're not trying to shut down oystering completely in Texas. I mean, that's what the other side is. It started bubbling up, and some of the stuff I've heard back is, you know, people being against it because they said, oh, they're just shutting it down completely.
No, they're not, Scott. There's two things happening at the same time, which would lead you to believe that. But the public fishery this season has effectively closed because there's just not enough market oysters available anymore. So they had to close the bay systems down using this traffic light system that the industry actually helped the department develop. The department and the industry worked together to develop the system so that you didn't over harvest in a shellfish harvest area. So that's moving at the same time this other proposal, this proposal to close the Mesquite Bay complex is moving. So the impression to people that don't take their time to become educated on the issue is that they're trying to shut everything down, but that's not the case. You have a sensitive area that has seen a dramatic increase in harvest from the commercial fishery that the department's trying to protect. But then also at the same time, you have these other harvest areas that have been closed just because there's not enough oysters in them any longer.
I mean, I know a few of the reasons, but can you go over why there was a higher harvest in those particular areas this year, whereas normally it's spread out and it's not so concentrated?
Yeah. So to do that, we should just back up to the mid 2000s. And, you know, everybody's heard the story of Hurricane Ike and silting over 80% of the oyster reefs in Galveston Bay. I think we talked about that last time I was on.
Right.
That shifted a lot of harvest pressure since then to the middle coast and the coastal bend. So the Galveston Bay system still has not recovered. And that bay system used to supply most of the market oysters coming out of Texas. Well, now we have all of those active licenses participating in the fishery that used to be in Galveston have shifted to the middle and the lower coast. And going into this season, you know, we had a lot of fresh water in bay systems that further concentrated these fishermen into areas that contained, that still contained a healthy population of oysters. And as a result, the immediate and dramatic impacts to those areas has been, alarming.
And out of state pressure too, correct?
Right. And out of state pressure, the number of out of state licenses has gone up in the last 5 years. We have a moratorium on oyster licenses that went into effect in 2005. And when that law was passed, the oyster industry lobbied for the effective date of the moratorium to not go into a place immediately. At the time that the law was being passed, there were like 380 oyster licenses out there. Well, since there was a delay in the implementation date of the moratorium, the oyster industry bought a bunch more oyster licenses. So we saw this rapid increase in the number of licenses prior to that effective date of the moratorium. And so that moratorium was almost had the opposite effect of what it was intended to do. And so some of those licenses were being fished, some were not being fished, but here recently, a lot more of them have been activated and they're participating in the fishery. And quite a number of those are being transferred to out-of-state vessels from Mississippi, vessels from Louisiana are coming over here and fishing the Texas waters. And so, yeah, we've seen in the last 5 years, pretty rapid increase in those out-of-state vessels fishing in Texas public waters.
And Caleb, I know you have firsthand experience with all sorts of oysterers, if that's the right term, in Matagorda, and they tend to maybe even bend the rules a little bit because they're from out of state. They don't care, and I'm not putting everybody in the same boat here, but I know that's something that you've experienced. What are your thoughts on what you've heard so far from Shane?
I know there were a lot of guys that were pretty hostile towards the things that were going on with those oyster boats, and I don't know if it's a possibility or not, but, and you know, a handful of fishing guides aren't your best source for information, but a lot of them were saying they were out of country people down here working. Illegally was the term used quite often, but again, a lot of fishing guides, I don't know how much we really know about whether that guy's licensed or not. But yeah, you know, we've seen them do a lot of unscrupulous things out there and some stuff that, you know, isn't deemed legal by definition. Do you think there is any chance that they'll end up making Texas you need to have a state license to work in our state waters? And if you are an out-of-state corporation, go back to your state? Do you think that is a thing?
There's not the legal authority to stop those transfers to out-of-state vessels. A lot of participants in the Louisiana fishery are heavy hitters in the Texas oyster fishery, and they float back and forth between their leases in Louisiana and the public reef system in Texas. And so while that's certainly a possibility of something that could be discussed at the legislative level right now, that's not something that is, I don't think, legally possible. I will say that, you know, you hear the comment about who's working oysters and who's working the vessels. And I think we need to understand that a lot of folks rely on this fishery for their livelihoods and their incomes. And for me, it doesn't matter who's working on the vessel. As long as they're doing it and following the rules, it shouldn't matter where they come from. And they're just trying to earn a buck, trying to make some money so they can feed their families. What is frustrating for me is the fact that it's the industry as a collective that has employed all of these additional people by increasing the number of active licenses in the fishery. So now you have more people reliant upon this fishery for their income, but our resource continually year after year is diminishing. There's mm-hmm. fewer and fewer oysters available to market, no matter what the reasons are, whether they're environmental or whether they're man-made causes. We know for a fact that it's harder and harder to meet the demands of the market with the Texas public oyster fishery.
Well, let me ask you this with that in mind, Scott and Caleb and myself, and I'm sure you are consumers. I mean, you practically need to talk my wife off the ledge here, because I told you the story off air. My wife is a pescatarian. She doesn't eat anything but fish and shellfish, you know, as her staple food. And she asked me to pick up a quart of oysters at that old Texaco in Sargent, which I go in there and get a quart and come home. And the other day I went in there and they said, oh, no, the season's closed now. I was like, oh, that's right. But myself, you almost got to pick your spots. I was good with it because, you know, I think this is terrific oystering legislation. And obviously the fishery is so eminently important. But at the same time, I'm sure people listening to this podcast are like, but man, I like oysters. What does it mean for the consumer?
It means that I miss an entire oyster season, and it's one of my favorite things on the planet to eat.
Exactly.
Buddy Seafood is where we get ours. And I went another day and she's like, man, we don't have much left.
So talk us all off the ledge here, Shane.
Yeah, there's, I don't want to say fix the fishery, but there's ways to turn this thing around. We've suggested a couple of paths forward for the department to consider. Obviously, you can look at other states and whatever states have done to be successful to keep oysters to market, and you know, some good lessons to be learned there. Hopefully, the industry comes up with some solutions as well. But you know, outside of relying just on the public fishery, we need to put more oysters in the water. Mm-hmm. So that happens through private lease programs. We have about 2,300 acres that are currently being leased in Galveston Bay. The Louisiana fishery has a massive private lease component. And so we need to expand that here in Texas. And we've suggested two things specific to leases. One is this idea of a conservation lease, where the CCAs of the world, Heart Research Institutes, Galveston Bay Foundation, they can lease bay bottom and do massive large-scale restoration projects, and those areas would be permanently off-limit to public harvest, but you can place them in spots adjacent to public reefs so they are supplying the oyster larvae and the seed to continually reseed the adjacent public reefs. The other part of that lease idea is to just expand it for the privatization of the commercial fishery. Allow anybody that wants to enter into a lease program, obviously it's going to be your major stakeholders that have the capital to do so initially, but a lot of the independent small-time fishermen could look into forming co-ops and doing this collectively, but they could lease bay bottom and place their shell that they process back out into the water, and they'd have exclusive harvest rights to that area. So those are a couple of things that we've suggested. We also need to try to look at expanding the oyster farming or the mariculture program. Almost all other states have coastal states have a significant mariculture or oyster farming program. And that's a really great way to get oysters to the half shell market. So those are some things we have asked the department to do and look at moving forward. And so after this March commission meeting, like moving into May and then the August meeting, some of those ideas will be discussed with the public and with the oyster industry, and hopefully we can come out of this thing with a better program than we already have.
Scott, I know you have something else here, or you look like you do, and then we're going to get into trout regulations since we have Shane with us, the new regulations, but I do want to just mention March 3rd, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Wortham Auditorium, first floor in Galveston, Texas. Is the public hearing, is a public hearing. Another one, 6 to 8 p.m., same day, March 3rd, Rockport Beach Park, Saltwater Pavilion in Rockport, obviously. Another one, March 3rd, 6 to 8 p.m., At the at 305 Henry Barber Way at the Bauer Exhibit Building in Port Lavaca, Texas. And, of course, people can do it online as well on the public comment page until 5 p.m. on March 24th. So that's just information if anybody wants to get in on these public hearings, state their case, state their opinion, et cetera. But, Scott, do you have something else before we get into it? You look like you did before we get into the trout regulations.
No, just as he was talking, I mean, who could be against that?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it only makes sense. You know, let's have a healthier bay system and have a healthier oyster system. Leasing is the way to go, I think. One thing we do need to make clear on that for the fishermen is when they lease that doesn't mean you can't go in there.
That's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up.
Not like a deer lease.
Yeah.
You know, it's not this area is marked off, fenced off, and you can no longer fish there. It's still open bay. You can still fish there. You just can't harvest oysters.
Yeah.
If anybody really wants to dig further into this, and I appreciate you mentioning those public meetings, we want everybody to weigh in on this deal and provide their input, and certainly leave a comment for Parks and Wildlife on that proposal. But ccatexas.org/oysters. We have anything and everything on there related to this proposal, and then also just a bunch of information on the value of the habitat and the value of the resource. So ccatexas.org/oysters is kind of like your one-stop shop on everything oysters.
And one more thing here with you, at least one more thing. I think these two things kind of work hand in glove. The oystering, you know, issue that we're talking about, and the smaller the new trout regulations. Between the two of them, I don't know if you agree or disagree, we'll all be talking about big trout in a matter of 2, 3, 4, 5 years, because correct me if I'm wrong, Shane, with one or the other, it's good. With both of these things, we're talking great fishing.
No doubt that enhanced an enhanced oyster fishery is going to enhance your trout species. And just the relationship the trout have with oyster reefs, especially mid bay reefs, it holds massive schools of speckled trout. So we're going to see a pretty rapid increase in the spawning stock biomass as a result of those regulations. And if we can get more oysters in the water, that's only going to help that fishery. So those rules were published in the register, and they will go into effect March the 20th. March the 10th.
Okay.
They had to be published for 20 days, but they go into effect March the 10th. 17 to 23 inches, bag limit of 3 everywhere south of Sargent.
So, Caleb, come March 11th, you and I are going to be catching a bunch of 26, 28-inch trout, I guess, huh? Caleb?
We need to mention, remind people, it expires. The rule expires August 31st, 2023.
John, you got to be realistic, man. This needs going to need some time to rebuild. It's 13th or 14th is
okay,
the probability.
Okay, 13th or 14th, we're going to be waiting on those 28-inch trout. I mean,
don't act silly in front of the science guy, okay? Let's be realistic.
But, Caleb, on those two things working together, I'm excited. You know, I haven't been this excited about the future of the fishery in a long time. And I think that's what a lot of our listeners need to realize. You're out on the water all the time. You see it, and you've talked about it on this podcast. I think one and the other combined is going to be nothing but good for us.
People argue there's quite a wad of people that will argue that everything's fine, everything's great, so forth and so on. But nobody will argue that from the days of old till today, the fishery has gotten weaker and weaker and weaker. And so seeing some changes that are trying to flatten the curve, even funny right now? Flatten the curve. And seeing some stuff to flatten the curve, it's a breath of fresh air. It's great to see. There's been a lot of people work a long time to, you know, put people in the places to make these changes. And, you know, I'm very excited about it.
And Shane, he mentioned that, and I really do sincerely, speaking for Scott and Caleb, which is always a dangerous thing, appreciate the work you guys do, because this is not you're kind of, you know, pushing against the water sometimes. I know when you're broaching these topics, but it's got to feel real good for both these things to be happening, just from your department's perspective.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is a challenge, as anybody could recognize. We just want more fish. We want more oysters. We want people to have a better time on the water, and we want our grandchildren and their children to be able to enjoy the resource as much as we do, if not more. So anything we can do to help us move in that direction, I think is a great thing to do.
Yeah, we want our grandkids to be able to, was it $350,000 boat by the time they get to fish?
Yes. If they can get a motor.
How much do you get out, by the way, Shane, to actually just go fish?
I talk about it way more than I do it. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay. You're here. We're going to take advantage of you being here. There's been big crab trap cleanup. It's an annual thing. And a lot of people, they tend to get in the way sometimes when you're trying to make a run or you're trying to fish a shoreline. I know in Sabine, it was just an ongoing thing for me, thousands and thousands of crab traps. I'm not exaggerating, especially on the East shoreline. What does that do? Give our listeners, a little 411 on what, this annual crab cleanup does and how it helps us hacks that are just casting and reeling.
Yeah, no, it's a great program. One of the old CCA guys, Ronnie Luster, he helped start that program. And we're right smack in the middle of this year's program. The first weekend was February the 19th. And I didn't get a coastwide report, but I think we had pretty good turnout. Typically, a lot of traps come out of Sabine, a lot of traps come out of San Antonio Bay, and then also the Aransas Bay area. And I saw some Aransas Bay folks post some pictures. They were out there this weekend, and they had quite a number on their vessels. But yeah, it's good to get those traps out of the water. So volunteers come in and try to remove all the derelict traps, because those traps have been there for a long time, and they just keep fishing. Crab traps never stop fishing. So if fish will go in there, it'll get stuck and it'll die. And then in that process, it attracts more fish or more crabs to come in. And so you'll continually have this perpetual fishing machine out there in the water. So if they're not being harvested, if the contents aren't being taken out, then it's just killing a bunch of resources that we'd like to keep alive. Crabs, terrapins, flounder, other bait fish, you name it. So, this program takes all those derelict traps out of the water every year and destroys them and makes the bay systems cleaner. So it's a great program, and we're happy to be associated and affiliated with it. And we appreciate the department spearheading that every single year.
What was the name of the program, Shane?
It's just a derelict crab trap cleanup.
I have a 19 Bravo XC that I'm going to name derelict crab trap cleanup, because I've got about four of them out of there for y'all.
How's that, Caleb? How'd you do that?
They also, yeah.
That prop will twist that thing up like an ice cream cone at the carnival, man. I keep some big old bolt cutters on my boat for that.
Yeah.
Scott, you've participated in this as well, haven't you, Scott?
Yeah, I've done it quite a few times. One of the first, it was like the second, third year we were doing it, me and Everett Johnson got on his airboat, and me and him and his wife Pam took off out across the bay there, and we absolutely loaded the boat four or five different times. We were maybe in the lead for bringing in crab traps that day. And Pam and I were a filthy, muddy mess.
They stink.
Back then, we were picking up traps. That was in the beginning of it. So we were picking up traps that had probably been out there for years. They were half buried. There was a couple of them. Pam and I got out there, and it took both of us to pull them up out of the mud. It was a mess.
Yeah, there's been over, and the official name, Caleb, I'm sorry, it's the abandoned crab trap cleanup. So you might have to rename your boat. but over 40,000 traps have been picked up, according to Parks and Wildlife, since the program began in 2002.
Man.
I think we got a third of those on that one day.
Caleb, how many you got of those?
I think derelict fits me better than abandoned.
I think you're right.
I've got six or seven of them, and they're serious. It'll stop a 300 horse Mercury instantly.
And knock on wood, I've never picked one up. I've come close a couple times. Hey, Dad, there's a crab right in front of you. Oh,
I'm gonna add that to my "You Ain't No Fisherman" video that I did with Dale Brisby.
We're gonna continue the podcast, but we really appreciate you joining us. That's real good information. Obviously, open invite. Anytime there's some updates, there's some news that our thousands of listeners will want and need to know. But I'll just give you the floor here before we let you go. If there's anything that we're missing that you need to and would like to add to all this.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. I just encourage people to participate in that public comment process. Read the proposal. Give Parks and Wildlife your comments based upon how you see the situation for Mesquite Bay and participate in this opportunity to offer your input.
All right, boys. I felt like I was kind of shortchanging the two of you on comments there because we had Shane on. So I'm just going to kind of go to both of you here. We still got plenty more to cover in the podcast, but I think we can all agree, Caleb, I'll start with you, but I think we can all agree that, as much as we don't want to sway people too much on certain issues, we want to sway people on this issue. You're still going to eat oysters. You're still going to, be able to have that dinner with your girl or your guy, because we have so many female listeners. But the fishery is going to be that much better. And I'm no BS, man. I'm really, this is about encouraged as I've been, Caleb, in a long time about prospects of catching big trout, which of course is what I like to do as my number one. What were your takeaways there?
I mean, I'll go ahead and say it. I feel like a lot of these conversations, whether it be the trout rigs, the oyster, anything, if we could just take the me out of it and focus more on the us and the them and the future and all of that, that it all makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
We're in a society right now where it's cool to post memes on Facebook, making fun of this and making fun of that and disagreeing with this and disagreeing with that. But there's very little substance behind them, but they kind of get a chuckle out of them. And people fall into line with it because of the chuckle you get out of it. What's the movie Idiocracy, where they're using Gator, Brondo. You pour some Brondo on it yet, bud? But I mean, the fact of the matter is something needs to be done. Like I said earlier, there's no denying that the fishery has gotten weaker over the past 30 or 40 years. There's no denying there's more pressure, all that kind of stuff. There's going to have to be some sacrifices to be made. It's that simple.
Say it, Caleb. Go ahead and say it.
If it comes down to not being able to keep a single fish and that results in me never being able to fish a tournament again, I'll do it. There's my me right there. I will willingly do it. I don't think it's going to come to that. I hope it doesn't come to that. But the fact of the matter is, put up or shut up. There's my put up right there.
All right. And Scott, you and I have been fishing literally since the 70s. We're about the same age. And everything Caleb said, I remember going to places where the fishing was just stupid, so good. And oysters were everywhere. And big trout were everywhere. So especially you, because you've been doing it professionally for so long, this is something that it's one of those things I hate to say, trust me, because you sound like you're preaching, but trust me, it will get back to that if we do it the right way.
I kind of shake my head sometimes. I hear the younger guys, man, it's as good as it's ever been. No, it's not.
Yeah, it's not.
You hear that quite a bit. Guys in their 20s, guys in their 30s, man, this is as good as I can ever remember. We're not in any trouble. We are in trouble. I can tell you that it wasn't that many years ago that wading off into pretty much anywhere you wanted to go, you could stop, you'd run a shoreline and you'd see the slicks, you'd run past two or three other guys that were wading. There wasn't any reason to get anywhere near them because there was more fish further down the shoreline. They were scattered out. We had enough fish around for everybody to not get run over everybody else. And now it's gotten to a point, and that's where we are now. Is it's more crowded. There's fewer fish, and we're starting to see more and more fish rage. You know,
yeah,
just like road rage, and you see it every day on social media. Somebody posting a picture. Somebody got too close to them. I remember fishing Galveston. You know, we had a little bit of that. The old timers say, "Put your rod down," you know, so that their little spot could be, you know, remain somewhat private. Mm-hmm. And I was of that mindset, and I ended up going down to Mansfield, and Mansfield was like the Wild West frontier out there. Wasn't anybody down there hardly on the weekdays. And I'm on some fish, and I'm standing right along the side of the intercoastal. I'm hooked up, me and a buddy, and this boat comes by, and as they're coming, my buddy's like, "Put your rod down, put your rod down." So we put our rods down, and those guys slowed down. They stopped and looked. I couldn't stand it anymore. I had a big trout on, so I'm landing my big trout. Hell with it.
Yeah.
And those guys waved at us, said, "Hey, man, looks like y'all doing pretty good." "Yes, sir." And they fired up and took off.
Mm-hmm.
They just slowed down just to see what we were catching.
They were interested, yeah.
And they didn't crowd us. Hell, they disappeared over the horizon. I don't know where they went.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get back to that. That, you know, those were some cool days.
I can remember. Well, I'm old enough now to be able to kind of say that I've put a lot of time into this, into learning it, into meeting people like y'all and you know, some other people in my life that have made me a better fisherman. I've got a lot of tools in the belt, right? In 2000, 2001, whenever I was still super duper green and, you know, just terrible gear, all that, it was easier for me to go catch a bunch of fish then than it is now with the skills that I've acquired over, you know, the last 22 years. It's simple. There's nothing to argue about it. And mm-hmm. It can be very neat to, you know, get back to half of that even. It'd
yeah.
be a great time.
The other thing about this that's interesting to me is we all love our skinny water boats. I mean, all of us, you know, the skinnier, the better. Well, the proliferation of skinny water boats and the oystering and the higher limits, they can't coexist. You know, that's the other thing, Scott. When you and I used to go fishing in skinny water, when we started wading, it was up to our chest because our boats wouldn't get that skinny. I mean, I remember I had a ladder on the boat and then trying to touch the bottom with my tippy toe and all that other stuff. Well, you know, if you like your skinny water boats, and we all do, I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. You know, they really can't. That's something that's not really talked about. We got guys that can go everywhere that other generations couldn't simply get into and without, you know, getting out of the boat in chest deep water.
Yeah, there was a lot more fish refuges back then because of the skinny water. I mean, there was places where we had to wade for miles.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, a long, long ways from the boat because the boat just wouldn't go there. Mansfield was a perfect example. And there was a lot of area down there that, you know, you pulled up on the edge of the intercoastal and you went a little ways in there and that was about as far as you were going to take the boat. And if you wanted to fish further up there, you just got out and walked.
Those were rubber waders too, man. They weren't comfortable. Rubber and neoprene came along.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had more than a couple occasions where I got some water right down the front of my chest.
Those are stupid pants with two O's.
Yeah. Yeah.
I filled up many a pair of waders.
Yeah. So yeah, you can't have it both ways, kind of, you know, so to speak. Yeah, so we'll get into a couple of other things here real quick, but I do want to mention this. Speaking of boats and these skinny water boats, you guys know I was down in South Padre last weekend. It was a blast, man. I was there for 3 days. It was a lot of fun. Didn't do a lot of fishing. We were doing some videos and stuff, but it was just fun seeing that beautiful water. But I did catch up with Chet Morimpudi about these prices, man. And we just got asked the question, why are they so much and will they ever go down? I mean, if you're a fisherman, you've seen what I've seen. Boat prices in every realm are just going up through the roof, especially in the last 2 years. Exactly why are these boat prices going so high? We get inflation, we get the pandemic, but I'm sitting with Chet Morimpudi from Freedom Boats, and It's a question that a lot of people just ask me, so I thought I would ask you, Chet. Outside of the obvious that I just mentioned, why is it that in the last 2-3 years, really in the last year especially, prices have gone from, let's say, a 30,000 boat is now 47,000. A $50,000 boat is now 75,000. Is it just, well, I won't even ask you. What is it?
That's the most common question I always hear from everybody. Why are the prices go up? The main thing is, since we got hit by COVID, the supply was so high, I mean, so low, and the demand was so high. Most of the material, they either imported or, you know, exported for somewhere else. It's all different, but everything is all about a lot of the factories who manufacturing the material. Like when I say material, like the core material, like the resin, the gel coat, or the base color, the pigment what you use, and all the fiberglass fabrics. Everything with the manufacturer, they all shut down. So the demand got so high, they can only produce X amount of product. So that created a lot of influx in the price. Just to give an example, in the last 6 months, just the resin went up by like 20 to 25%, which is the main skeleton to make a boat. Then you can imagine why the prices went up. Same thing, all the aluminum went up, so the trailers went up. The wood, it's not the boat builders who's trying to sell it for more price because everybody wants a boat. No, it's this.
Well, the million-dollar question is, will these prices ever go down or level out, let's say in a year or 2 years? Because there is competition. I mean, you're Freedom Boats. You've got competition all over the place. I mean, you know, Maudi and Shallow Sport, and we can just go down the list. Will they go down? Will the competition help the consumer at some point?
Basically, the price of the boat is based upon the cost of material. Unless the suppliers, like, you know, any boat builder, Freedom, Maudi, Shoalwater, Shallows, anybody, if the suppliers who supply us the material, if they go down, yes, automatically the prices will go down. But you can see.
And, you know, we were down in South Padre Island with you. People were just blown away by the Freedom boats. I mean, I just got to ask you this since I have you here. I knew my Warrior. I tell people all the time, best boat I've ever had. You don't understand. It'll run in 10 inches. It'll get up in a foot. And I was running with the Chiquita, like, you know, step for step. I mean, everything the Chiquita did, I could do, but except maybe like up in 4 inches of water running. Is there anything that about that weekend? I asked JT Koshy this, but anything about that weekend where we were out running some boats and you're going to enhance your website, which is why we're doing videos and pictures, that even surprised you about the Freedom boats and how they handled and how they performed?
The most important thing amazed me is the water down here. I seen running Freedom boats skinny, but I know that the water over there is like 3 inches or 4 inches. But here, it's like crystal clear. It's like a mirror. I can see the bottom of the boat when they're passing by me, when I was taking the photographs. I can see the bottom of the boat so clear in those waters. I mean, sometimes I feel very proud of myself, but like today when I saw these photographs and the way they ran in this clear water, man, it's mind-boggling. It's awesome. I have no words to say.
Is there anything happening with Freedom Boats right now before we let you go that you want to tell the Bite Me listeners, because I know a lot of them are interested? What's on the horizon for your industry, for your company, I should say, now that you're really taking it up a notch?
John, you're really twisting my arm. You know, not you, but a lot of the listeners and a lot of the people I know, they always want to know what is the next thing. But anyway, you know, let me spill the beans. It took almost 8 months to design our Freedom 26-foot General. So finally, after going back maybe like 40 or 50 different designs, we finalized one design. We just finished the plug, and we're about to start building a mold. So all going well, come July 2022, which is going to be the model year 2023, we'll be launching our Freedom 26-foot General boat.
The General. Man, that sounds awesome. That is, I had heard about this for months, and I know it's been your pet project, but I've seen your design. I've talked to you about this. There are people who say it actually runs as skinny, if not skinnier, than my Warrior.
Okay, right now, all the numbers is spit by a computer. But if the design, if the computer is right, it's going to run shallower than your 23-foot Warrior. I mean, I don't blame you if you're going to sell the boat and get into a 26.
All right, that's Chet Morimpudi from Freedom Boats. Congratulations, man. We had a blast. Thanks for having us.
All right, boys. That was good information. We'll see how promising it is in the future. Good question from the podcast. Let's get to one of the questions from our podcast. Caleb, I'm going to start with you because I think you can speak precisely to this. The question came up from someone who
I got to give him credit. He ditched everything, all his freshwater gear, just ditched it all. Said, I want to catch saltwater fish. I'm going to become a saltwater fisherman and made that and is making that change. And he actually asked the question. I crossed over about a year ago, selling my bass boat and tournament gear. So he was serious. Went headfirst into inshore fishing. It has been an adjustment to say the least, but I'm getting there. What would you recommend? Is there any special, Scott, I know you have thoughts on this too, but Caleb, but you know, going from freshwater to saltwater, we have a lot of our listeners, a lot of people moving to Texas, a lot of people from out of state that want to come down here and get into saltwater fishing. What do you tell those freshwater guys when they turn to saltwater?
Is there any way to get your bass boat back?
Don't do it. Don't do it. Go the other way.
It depends on what you're doing. The kind of red fishing that I do is very bass fishing esque. I use a lot of crank baits. I use a lot of chatter baits, and redfish kind of act like bass, and it's very similar. Your retrieves and everything are very similar. Trout, they're a totally different animal than bass are. I'd pick one or the other and just hone in on it and spend that time doing it. I did the same thing. I went from bass fishing to saltwater. You know, I grew up down at Choke Canyon, Amistad, Falcon, you know, all those. You hear a lot of cool stories about those lakes, and they're very cool lakes. In fact, Choke Canyon is our old ranch that got eminent domain and filled with water. Pretty cool to take your dad down there, and he could look at a hill and say there's a set of working pins and a water trough right here. And it'd get pretty nasty on that lake. But then whenever I went over to saltwater fishing, I redfished first. I redfished for years and years, and that's just what I did. And it translated really well with the bass fishing. And then I got some sick, twisted idea that I wanted to trout fish. And that took quite a bit of getting used to and changing up and understanding the nuances of it. But, you know, pick a craft or, you know, one or the other and just hone in on it is about all I can really tell you as far as that goes.
What are your thoughts, Scott?
Wash your stuff. Everything rusts.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that.
Probably the biggest takeaway is I read the question. Things to remember crossing over. Your stuff's going to deteriorate a lot faster in saltwater. The rods and reels that we have today, they're made for saltwater. I see people, I've got my freshwater stuff. It's not made for saltwater. They're all made for saltwater. The rod and reel companies, they're not going to just make something strictly for fresh. Very often, occasionally there is. If you're into that and you've been doing that tournament fishing, you're used to having 10 different rods. And I was in the sales business for a long time in rod sales, and it was just amazing to me how specific they were on their actions and how specific they were. This one is made for this lure. Mm-hmm. And we don't see that near as much in saltwater. I think it's a little bit of overkill on freshwater personally, but in saltwater, you can get away with a lot less technical equipment. And overall, I think saltwater is probably easier in some respects because it's more basic to me. You know, I mean, the fish are going to eat shrimp, they're going to eat mullet, and they're going to eat crabs. And all we have to do is figure out which one they're eating and try to duplicate that movement. In freshwater, man, I mean, they start talking about red flake versus a silver flake and a green worm makes a difference from one day to the next, and I don't get that.
Yeah.
I don't want to be that technical.
But it is true. I mean, you talk to the bass fishermen, and they'll swear by color a lot more than we do. Caleb, one thing I thought of on this when I saw the question was the backbone of the rod. And it speaks to what you're talking about with redfish. You know, you have those heavy backbones on the rods, the stronger rods. If you're going to start with redfish, that's something that you could cross over, correct?
I use a lot of flipping and flipping rods. I think they're flipping and pitching rods. That's what I use. I used to use that a lot redfishing. I don't use them much anymore, but I used to use that a lot. But you know, I kind of been putting some thought into my answer a while ago. And, first off, if you realize magnesium in it, not so much for the salt water. It'll work great for a while. But my main point is, if you're really into the bass fishing and the blue flake or the silver flake or the gold flake, and like that's what keeps you up at night, then you might fall right into trout fishing. It might be just great for you. Because this is what you do as a trout fisherman, is worry about every little stinking color on it, you know, and there's just lots of ins and outs and whatnot.
Hey, drink, everybody. Earlier I said that. Caleb, say it.
They only get one. You know, you can have a good time. I'll help you have a good time until you give me crap about it. Then the good time's over.
Those who are not on the Bite Me group page on Facebook, I don't have it in front of me, but somebody gave you a little bit of a hard time about whatnot.
Look, I mean, just, you know, yeah, whatnots.
Oh, you said it twice.
That is my way of saying and other things. All right. Or
we all have
et cetera.
Our crutches. Yeah, we all know, have our.
You remember when we first started the show, y'all made fun of me for absolutely. Absolutely was like my word.
When you say y'all, you mean Scott.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah, Scott. Yeah, factual. You know, it's. I'm just trying to communicate, man.
What is Scott's crutch?
What he's doing there is he's just giving his mind a second to catch up with his mouth.
Exactly. That's exactly. We all have that doing. Crutch.
Yeah, but Scott's sure. crutch is. Scott's crush is just, man, sheer age and wear and tear. he speaks pretty well. It's just his overall status as a what do you call it? Wisdom bearing old fella.
I'll tell you what Scott's crutch is. And the only reason I know it is because I edit this podcast every week. And I don't want you to stop doing it because it helps your answer, Scott. But a lot of times when we're having a discussion and it kicks to you, we hear this. And then you go, there's a little bit of a pause. But that's actually fine for us because it's easy to edit. Cause I just look at the editing line. I'm like, okay, there's a space. That must be where Scott's talking. Boop, erase that.
What about this one? He starts a lot of sentences with eh.
Yeah. I hadn't noticed that too much. Yeah. I guess not. Hey, speaking of, but you know, hey, it's what we are. We're, you know, one of us is a paid professional and the other two are not. And I don't think I do any better than you two. So there's that.
I don't say that. Call us paid.
Huh? When I saw that A, that's just me trying not to jack with Caleb. It just gives me that moment of, I can think about back. It, but I'm not going to say it.
He's holding back. Imagine if he didn't hold back, Caleb.
We
were mentioning rod and reels, and this has been on the rundown, and it's kind of fallen through the cracks at least 4 weeks in a row. So since we were talking about rods and crossing over, et cetera, let's put it in this week for sure. It was a question I got right after Christmas, so more than a month, about a fellow that got his wife got him kick-ass, by the way, from Fishing Tackle Unlimited, so good for him. He got a really, really nice, you'll know the model, the real light one that I like, the green rod, Scott, the G2, what's it called?
Right. It's the green rods. It's the newest one of the green rods.
So he got that and got a brand new, really good reel. It's about a $500 package. And he says he was nervous. He texted me. It was actually, a direct message on Twitter. Or Instagram, one of those two. And he said, I'm a little nervous about what do I do? I don't want to ruin these things. Is there such a thing, Scott? This is in your wheelhouse. You were in the industry for a long time as properly sort of not just breaking in the rod and reel, but breaking in that relationship, you know, between you and the rod and reel. What would you tell him? Because I just gave him the rudimentary stuff.
One of the biggest things is to take care of the rod. Rods don't break for no reason. You know, you'll hear that all, man, I was just fishing and I set the hook and I broke my rod. Rods break from previous damage that was minor. If you're going to leave it in the rod holder, which I don't suggest, which we all do it from time to time, take the lure off. That lure, especially a lead head banging into the rod and hitting the blank, that's causing little bruises in there. Every time it hits, it bruises the fibers. It's a weak spot. Eventually the rod will break at that point. you see a whole lot of rods that break just above the cork, right mm-hmm. where people hook the lure on and leave it there and let it bang around. Any kind of, you know, sharp hits, I cringe when I see rods hanging out of the back end of a tailgate, you know, hanging over the tailgate going down the road, because every one of those rods is getting a weak spot in it. Other than that, just wipe them down, you know, put a little of that, the blue stuff from Fishing Tackle Unlimited that I like so much. It's actually everywhere now. I see it all over the place at Real Wash. I use it on my rods. It takes care of any salt that's in those little cracks and crevices of the eyes. That's where you'll usually see the damage start. You'll see that little rust developing right where the eye goes into the threads. You spray it down with that, wipe it off if you feel like it, leave it alone if you, you know, if you're getting a little lazy. Same thing with your reel. Wipe it down, soft cloth, spray it with the reel wash, and then about once a year or so, take it into a good reel repair guy. If you're not comfortable breaking it down yourself, take it to somebody like that and let them go over it. They'll probably tell you it needs new bearings or it needs a new pawl or something, but it'll make your reel last forever.
Yeah, wiping them down, oiling them. What I do on my boat is whenever I'm washing my boat at the end of it, I'll leave my rods and my reels in there, and I don't pressure wash them direct. I'll stand about 10 feet back from them and just give it all a good, I don't know, 10, 15 second mist. And call it a day on that. That's a little bit easier for somebody to do. I would say it's probably not as good as using the real wash salt away stuff like Scott has, but just getting some fresh water in there and breaking down the salt. You know, one thing you were talking about the broken rod, Scott, Chris from Laguna told me that if it's blank failure, where they break at is about 2 feet above the handle. He said that is what blank failure is. He said all the other places are from the nicks and chips and the one little weak spot in that graphite.
You know, I told you guys that I gave him the rudimentary stuff. Let me give it now and get your thoughts in case there's anybody who really, you know, is interested as well. It's not so much the case anymore, but I never hook the lure on the eyes. Hook it on the bottom, because back in the day you would have the little – now they're mostly just – stainless steel or chrome or whatever it is, and they don't mark as much, but they could still bring rust, as you mentioned, Scott, or little notch in there eventually from repeatedly putting it in. Don't ever hook your hooks in the eyes. I told him, you know, to be easy on the dial. I don't even know if it has an official name, Scott, the dial that allows how much line, you know, how loose the line is coming off what's it called?
Tension knob.
Tension knob. Be easy on the tension knob. Because that can really be depressing if you give it too much too soon. And then the other thing, Caleb, you just alluded to it. I said, don't pressure wash them per se, because that just knocks more grit and grime into the reel. You need to mist them or use the reel wash, as Scott was saying.
What it does whenever you're hanging on those eyelets too is if you don't have recoils, it'll pull those ceramic inserts out. That happens to my spinning gear a lot, where my customers just hang the lure on it and reel it up and set it in the rod holders. It'll pop those little ceramic inserts out, which isn't good for anything.
All right. What would Scott do? What would Caleb do in just a minute? But since we're on this, and I was talking about the South Padre, really good personal question I had for JT Koshy over from the boatyard, because I had the electronic gas gauge not really calibrated right. So I just flat out asked him proper way to calibrate. I know a lot of people can have those and they don't even rely on the dials per se anymore, but calibrating an electronic gauge. We're running the Chiquita and the Patriot and the Warrior in every single condition you could imagine. I was blown away. We had 25-mile-an-hour winds early. We got into some great weather. We went skinny. We went chop. We went rough. We went everything you can imagine. And it just blew me away. So I'm sitting with JT Koshy from the Boatyard, and just wanted to ask about that. And then a very common problem that we actually ran into out on the water, calibrating electronic fuel gauges. Everybody's going electronic. Some people, like myself, don't even have the hard gauges, so to speak, anymore. So that's something that a lot of our listeners really want to find out about. But first of all, on the behavior out there on the water of all three boats, I was blown away, and I have a Warrior, and I've had, this is my second one. Some guys out there had never really handled a Warrior, and they were saying, oh, we're going to get wet, we're going to get wet. I'm like, no, you're not. Did anything about the day on the water, 10 hours in all these conditions, really impress you, and you do it all the time?
Yeah, John. So if you ask any boat manufacturer, if you ask any boat dealer, they're going to say their shallow water boat is the best boat. Why wouldn't you, right? But, I mean, nothing surprised me today. The wind was blowing 25 in the morning. We had two guys out on a Chiquita, and you could tell they were not roughed up. They were comfortable, and they were both wearing socks, shoes, and pants, and were dry, which is insane. For someone who doesn't know, I'm used to it, so I figured they'd be all right. But if they did that in a 14-foot Chiquita, you must have been sailing on a couch. And I was running a Patriot today, nice and easy. I'm not too roughed up. I feel good. I was dry the entire time except when I jumped out to wade. Awesome, man. Awesome. If anyone wants to ride on one, call when it's choppy. Call when it's smooth. We'll run in skinny water anytime.
And you said off-air that you want people to call you about this calibration problem, because this is not a problem, but this, tutorial. Because you're helping me with it, and it's something that I figure if I have it, a lot of our listeners are maybe not having problems with trying to figure out how to calibrate their fuel gauges. So take us through that real quick, because so many people are doing that now.
Digital fuel gauges. No more analog needle. You got a big screen on your boat. You wanted all your gauges on there. One of those gauges will be your fuel gauge. Two terms here, configure and calibrate. Configuring is you need to tell the device how many tanks you have and how many gallons does that tank hold. Number two is calibrate. The more calibration points you give, the more accurate your fuel gauge will be. I recommend doing the absolute max. Most of them have a 4 or 5 point calibration. Let's say if your tank is 20 gallons, choose 4 points of calibration. Take your boat to the gas station, fill up 5 gallons, calibrate, 5 gallons, calibrate, and so on till 20. And you'll have an accurate fuel reading. If you have any questions, give me a call or bring the boat by. I can 100% help you out. One way or another, I'll help.
That's JT Koshy from the Boatyard and a friend of the podcast, and he will help you out. Now let's get back to the podcast. Good stuff right there. Next, what would Scott do? What would Caleb do? Interesting weekend of weather that we've got, weekend of weather we've got. Also want to mention the text I got from Michael Acrylic over at Knock and Tail. I teased this last week, so I want to pay off the tease that he had something special coming down the pike, and he does. It's official. They're being shipped. Knock and Tail is going to be on the online store now. He's going to have brand new 5-inch and 3.25-inch Knock and Tail lures hitting the online store, and they're going to be available for viewing and for purchase at the Houston Fishing Show, which Scott and Caleb and I are all going to be there. And he's going to be able to sell those. You guys know those are really good. They were really popular down in South Padre, which was cool as well. And then, of course, Deadly Dudley is going to be around as well on both of those, deadlydudley.com, Bite Me 20. You can get the 20% discount. And Mike's got it going on as well. Mike Host Outdoors, you can probably get those at the online store right now, the new 5-inch, new 3.25-inch. Really looking forward to that 5-inch. I think they're going to be fun, easy to cast, and they're going to have great action with that knocker in the tail. That's at MikeHostOutdoors.com. You can also use the promo code, just like on Deadly Dudley, BITEME20, BITEME20, and you get 20%. All right, boys, this was a productive podcast, but let's make it more productive by getting some people on some fish. Interesting weather, Scott. I say interesting because I think there might be some promise somewhere down the line, but what are your thoughts?
Well, we're getting our weekly cold front on Friday.
Of course.
But if you can get out there Thursday, man, and Thursday's looking pretty good. There's a lower barometer.
There you go.
The afternoon.
Welcome to the club.
right before it goes crazy and we hit 40-mile-an-hour winds again overnight. here we go again. But Saturday, I mean, Saturday drops back down. It's overcast.
That's what I'm talking about, Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, the barometer is still staying up there for those of you who appreciate that kind of thing. Wouldn't bother me, but it's going to be overcast, cloudy, a little bit of rain here and there, spitting rain. I think it'd be a pretty good time. It'll be in the 50s. All that big trout stuff that everybody wants is kind of right there. You know, you got the overcast, you got spitting rain, you got miserable conditions. You can put your stupid pants on and go out there and wade and chunk your corkies and have fun.
You know, at the expense of getting one of those from Scott, the trout did eat the best on the highest pressure day of the week last week. Now he's 4-1 giggling.
4-1 for me.
Well, hold on. He's giggling and he's chuckling over there and whatnot.
Drink.
Get a buzz from somebody. But they starved to death for 4 days before it. Like, they had no choice. It was just, they had to eat something.
They refused to eat.
They had to eat. They had to eat. it depends on how much wind, rain we get. I may be going to some deeper refuge and looking into rivers and creeks and whatnot.
Now
to
that
see what goes on.
Drink is a great,
That went on purpose.
I'm telling you, that was a real one. That is a very good strategy right there. It's going to be cold, upper 40s, lower 50s. But midday is when you'll see me out there, Caleb. Be sure to wave, if you see me out there. And I'm looking at, maybe that river you're talking about as well. So, that's something to do, this week.
Really not showing a whole lot of rain with this. I mean,
it looked like a drizzle, right?
Yeah. I'm looking at just that light, nasty, drizzly 50 degree. Like I said, the kind of stuff you put your stupid pants on, get that rain jacket on and go out there and stand and throw in one spot for hours.
Oh, fun.
I'm going to be over, around Galveston. This
weekend.
Okay. Little teaser here. I'm going to run a different boat to see what happens with it.
And
if it works out, things could get plumb silly. I'll give y'all a hint. All right. If I do this, this isn't for sure. If I do this, okay, first off, I've got to get a Toyota truck, because to have one of these boats, you have to have a Toyota. And I've seen this coast wide, right? I can't own shoes. I need a flat brim hat with a rope across it. Anything else, Scott? I got to have a button up shirt with pliers on my hip, right? And like a leather belt. Like, I mean, got to look like I'm going to watch the, go to Midnight Rodeo when we do this.
What are you talking about?
Am I missing anything, Scott?
If you put a flat brim hat on, I'm going to disown you.
Well, but it's going to have the rope across it and a little point on the top.
Nope.
I'm going to look at a setup similar to Scott's. I'm thinking about possibly changing courses, but if I'm going to do this, I got to go all out. I got to have like the no shoes. I'm going to get an assorted set of corn cobs to just shove right at my butt whenever somebody in a tower boat tries to talk to me, and I can get all hoity toity with it. I mean, I'm going to be set up for this.
I tell you what, though.
Now that's a tease.
There's reasons for some of that stuff. You know, the no shoes thing, you spend enough time on a polling platform pushing and shoving a boat around with two people on the front of it, you will learn why you don't wear shoes, because you want to know where that edge is all the time. And you can reach over there and feel it.
What's the reason behind the corn cobs?
We're better than y'all.
That sounds very interesting. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. I've never understood why you're barefoot so much. I've never understood
that. That's exactly why.
Because it would burn my feet, and I would always have, whatever, blisters and calluses on the bottom of my feet. Not that they're that, pristine anyway, but I just never understood. I always got to have my little comfortable Crocs loafers or Columbia loafers or whatever, and I'm good to go. They get wet, and then they dry. That's how I do it.
Now you got to toughen up, be on that Poland's Gift and do that. A lot of Sol sunscreen goes on the top of my feet, and they still end up solid brown by the end of the year.
All right, boys. What do we got going on? Starting with Captain Caleb TV. What you have cooking there, buddy?
We're working on stuff. We're working on stuff. Look, full disclosure, I've been coaching kids baseballs a lot, and I have it this evening, Wednesday and Thursday, and this wind. I'm working on it. I'm going to try to do some stuff from the field in a couple of days. I am thinking that, you know, spring's starting to creep up on us, and people have always seemed to respond well to the what spring baits do we think is going to make it happen this year. I think that's what's going to happen, and you know, just other stuff and whatnot.
What spring break baits is what I just wrote down. Maybe we'll have a little crossover Bite Me podcast and Captain Caleb TV discussion.
I like.
By the way, when's the big behind the scenes pull the curtain back Captain Caleb TV video on what we do here?
I'm archiving. I'm archiving content.
All right.
Most of the stuff.
Make sure you know when to edit, when not to.
Yeah. Well, see, that's just it. Is the stuff that you edit out is the stuff I'm going to use.
Except I didn't do one thing last week. I was so embarrassed.
You realize?
At least there weren't any F bombs.
I think I say you guys have heard me talk for 2 years, and you would take this risk.
Exactly. Scott Null photography.com for your prints, of course, which I always like to promote because they're really, really, really cool and they're really, really, really good. And also Bite Me Gear. Is there any update? I haven't asked you in a while on Bite Me Gear.
Buy some Bite Me Gear. It's kind of slowed down a little bit. Pick up your Bite Me Gear and get it out of my closet.
All right. Hats.
Kind of takes up a lot of room in there.
Hats, shirts, different colored shirts. You can get it. You can find them all at scottmelphotography.com. Buffs, stickers. I still need to get some more stickers. Like my new boat, I need to get a sticker on there. Another one. I have one, but I need to get another one. And beyond that, make sure you put this part in the behind the scenes video, Caleb, because you're showing a lot of thigh there. And that was that can't be missed by people who see Captain Caleb TV. Now you're hiding your thigh.
Don't want to be looking like a
red shorty shorts.
I told you, I'm in coach mode, man.
Yeah, that was some really white thighs. I've never seen you look more white than when you lean back with those shorts on.
You can't say that in 2022.
I can't say that you have white thighs.
No, you can't say I look that white. I don't appreciate
it. You are incredibly white. Incredibly white. All right, boys.
Little update on the shoulder real quick. I finished my PT this past week.
All right.
And they have released me, and I now have almost 180-degree rotation and movement in my shoulder. Just got
work season, baby.
And they're talking about letting me get back at it sometime in May. So I'm going to slowly creep back out there on the water some, probably in April, just on my own, doing some little 2 and 3 hour poling trips just to get back in shape of poling. It's coming, man. It's coming along. I'm doing a lot of weightlifting and just getting ready.
All right. Time for tarpon season too.
Yep. Pick me. 2 hours is perfect.
Yeah. That's all you need.
Mm-hmm.
All right, guys. Y'all have a good weekend. I'll be out there. Caleb, I'm not going to be in Galveston. I'm going to be in Matagorda. But we'll have a fun time. There's more thigh on the way out. So we'll leave it at that. Hopefully you guys have a great week, and good stuff from Shane Bonneau. So thanks to him from all of us. Catch him up, and we will talk to you next time.